Welcome back to the Get Cyber Resilient Show. We've had a few weeks off for a winter break and returned for our first episode of Season 7 and remarkably, our 104th episode in total. Thank you so much to all our listeners. You make doing this all the worthwhile. This week is our Behind the News episode. I'm Dan McDermott, your host for today, and I'm joined by our resident cybersecurity expert, Garrett O'Hara. Today, we'll be looking behind the news of the brand risk associated with compromised social media accounts, as highlighted by the recent Disney hack. Next, we'll review the crypto crash and its impact on ransomware in both the short and longer term. Then, we'll look into how the backlash to the facial recognition rollout across major Australian retailers could have been avoided. And we'll end with a wrap of the latest breaches and vulnerabilities to make the headlines. So, Gar, welcome to Season 7. Let's begin by diving into the hack of Disneyland's Facebook and Instagram accounts.
Yeah, Season 7. Lucky Season 7. We should have bingo numbers for the episode numbers, you know. Lucky for some, number 7 or whatever it is.
That's right.
Disney. Okay, so this isn't anything new. You know, we've certainly seen social media accounts of many kind of large brands be hacked. I think there's something very emotional about Disney because it is associated with, at least for me still, lovely little cartoons and this sort of huge trust in Disney as a brand. And the real issue here is that I think it's what it's starting to do is point to the impact cybersecurity has on stakeholders outside of cybersecurity. You know, we talk about risk, and I think so often when we think about cybersecurity stakeholders, it's the board, you know, that drowns out every other sort of set of concerns people. But actually here you look at the damage that something like this could do to a brand. The nuance here is that it is social media. It was pretty obvious that it wasn't Disney. You know, this could have been worse in that somebody could have hacked the account and sent people to phishing links or used it as a way to kind of influence a topic or, you know, conversation. I know Disney was in a sort of a little bit of controversy around the sort of inclusivity conversation in the US at one point because they weren't being vocal enough. So you can imagine where there's potential for hacktivists and folks to do something similar, but actually with a view to getting a point across. In this case, a guy who's claiming to be a super hacker, and I always think that, in this kind of industry, if somebody's claiming to be a super hacker, they're probably not. You know, the super hackers are the ones that we never hear about by definition. But this guy's name is David Doe, or Doe, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, but was very offensive in the content that this person posted. So, kind of racist, aggressive language, lots of slurs and that sort of stuff. So in a way, Disney was lucky because it was very, very obviously not Disney that was posting this stuff on both Facebook and Instagram. So both of those were compromised. You're obviously a fairly senior marketer, and I'm guessing stuff like this would make you sort of anxious, right? Because it's such a trusted channel for communications with, directly with customers. And then when you see a compromise like this, that's the thing that I suspect many people will be paying attention to more and more. But we've certainly seen this where the interest in cybersecurity from the marketing and branding side of businesses has become much more acute because they're aware of what it means when they're the ones making the news to, whether it's been a hack or even a service outage because of a ransomware attack. And I think I've spoken to you before, Dan, about the watch that I'm kind of wearing at the moment. Fairly famous brand, and had an incident where a bunch of us in our fitness group, one of the mornings, we're like, hang on, we can't find GPS, the watches were all a bit wonky. And it was as a result of a ransomware attack. And there's a little bit of a wobble, something that I think is a great watch to that point. I'm like, oh, hang on a sec. If I can't use it for a week, then it's not really a great watch at all, is it? So, I think there's impact to brand in a very meaningful way with this stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I think David Doe may have sort of undone a little bit of his supposed super hacker credibility by also claiming that I think he started COVID-19 or created it. So probably not a lot of credibility. But as you said, there's certainly a lot of slander, right? And therefore, which does blow back onto Disney that it's on their channels, right? It's on their owned channels, and it's very much, how does they allow this to happen? And it's interesting that we talk about, you know, the responsibility of sort of cyber and brand reputation, and where does that lie within an organization? And I've spoken to a few very senior CMOs of very large Australian brands about this topic, because I thought this would be really interesting, right? Like they're going to really lean in and sort of understand, you know, brand reputation is, you know, particularly those big consumer brands, it's going to be number one or two on the most important things that they have in terms of their job description. I got significant pushback pretty quickly that it was like, that's not my job. Yeah. Like we have a cyber team, you know, that's on them. And I was really surprised because I thought, and probably being in the industry, sort of thought, but don't, like, it's like, don't you care? It's like, yeah, but it's like, it's not my problem. It's like, we've got a team that look after that. And I sort of thought, well, you know, who should be, you know, we talk about the boards and responsibility to the board, but who should be owning that item on the risk register? To me, it's not the cyber team, right? It should be part of the CMO actually doing that. And therefore, if they own that on the risk register and they need to be able to report on it and be able to show what is being done, it drives the collaboration with the CISO and the cyber team to make sure that, like, they are considering, you know, how are we protecting our social media accounts? Who's actually asked that question at Disney? Like, you know, has anybody even asked the question? And then it's like, then they start the internal blame game of, marketing should have done this, or, you know, the cyber team should have protected it more. It's like somebody has to own it and I think drive the conversation. And I think that for brand reputation, it has to be the CMO, because they're the ones ultimately that understand the implications and the ramifications of when it goes wrong, right? And so it's to me very clear that they should be driving the conversation. They won't own the outcome or the delivery of a, you know, of a policy or a procedure or a technology that protects, but they should drive the conversation internally. And I was surprised how little buy-in I got to that conversation. And I feel as though it will just take, you know, some more high profile sort of attacks like this where I think the conversation will flip. But unfortunately, it takes it being in the media and the front page of the news and all those sort of things to get the attention to say, we probably need to do things differently.
You raise a really interesting point, Dan, around who owns the risk, because the CISO doesn't own the risk in an organization. Like, that's a misconception, I think, that certainly gets kind of repeated often. You're spot on. Like, the CISO's job is to build a, you know, defensible strategy. You know, in conversation with the business, say, what is our tolerance for risk? What are we going to accept, transfer, you know, all of that good stuff. You know, the CISO doesn't own the risk. Their job is to, you know, evaluate where the risks lie, to your point. And then it's up to the business to actually own the risk. You know, they have to, you know, fundamentally pay for a program or not. That's the budget negotiation. And that's the reason, you know, the business is on the hook. So I totally agree with you. You know, it's not up to a security team to own the risk of what it means when a social media or other channel kind of gets hacked like that. Yeah, really is up to the business. And the other thing is, all of the value these days is intangible in sort of most organizations. It isn't the building you own. I mean, half the time people are just leasing buildings these days. They don't own corporate fleets. They don't own anything. There's a lot of operating expenses. And then the value of nearly every organization is in its IP. And it's in its brand. And, you know, you can think of the most valuable organizations on the planet. It's the little logo and the name of that organization. That's what you're paying for half the time. It's the feeling you get when you buy a certain type of phone or when you use a certain, you know, streaming platform or whatever. So
we know the power of social media as influencing, you know, consumer sentiment, right? And so if that then gets compromised, then that is a significant risk to that reputation and therefore the valuation of your organization. So, like, to me, there's no doubting that, like, this has to be front and center for the CMO. And I think the thing is, I think a bit of it is unknown, right? And, you know, it's a bit scary. So they don't know, like, you know, like what needs to be done. And I think therefore feel uncomfortable. Whereas I think they should just be asking the questions, be open to saying, like, where do our risks lie? What can we do? What do we have in place? is it all, it's not all technology, right? What is, you know, if something does go wrong, what was their remediation plan and how do they shut that down? And what's the conversation around that? Have they, you know, done the old desktop practice of those things and make sure that they understand what that looks like? I think there's so many things where like they can drive that conversation at a business level and bring the teams along to support them and to actually do it. And I think do it really well. I think that's the opportunity that lies ahead for all of these major brands is there's don't be afraid of it. This thing is out there and how do you sort of start to get in front and take control of it? And I definitely think that there's work to be done. And I think that unfortunately sort of it does take, you know, some high profile sort of hacks in order to sort of often change attitudes as well.
And the other thing you just kind of raised there is the issue with kind of broader trust in an organization, right? So and I think you said this right at the start where you look at sort of the fact that Disney's had its Facebook and Instagram accounts hacked. It points to, well, what else? And if I'm a customer of an organization and especially one that maybe is storing my data and potentially sensitive data, when I see something like this, you know, you kind of go, well, okay, well, if that happened, then what else is going on that, you know, maybe is going to impact me in a more meaningful way? And one of the things I've seen commented on, but, you know, I don't think it's an out, but it is that when you think about Facebook and Instagram, they're not really corporate platforms per se. You know, they are social media. They're quite often not amazing when it comes to, you know, security settings, etc. Like, yes, there's some privacy stuff, but they don't roll into often, sometimes they can, but they don't roll into the kind of corporate stable of managed environments. You know, people think of AD and the CRM and you know, access to email and those kind of things, where I feel like because they're sort of, I mean, they're not really that new anymore. Maybe I'm just getting old, but, you know, they sort of feel like there are these new things that sit outside of the kind of core, you know, standard corporate environment. And maybe we just need a shift mindset.
Indeed. And like you say, I think it is that perception of, is this the tip of the iceberg? So if somebody's getting into that, what else are people getting into and how vulnerable are the rest of your systems and that? So, and that might be a long bow to draw, but people think like this. And I think it's definitely a, you know, something that needs to be considered and understood as part of that overall risk mitigation, right? So it's definitely one, I think, for us to keep an eye on and not, like you say, not trivialize that it is, you know, oh, it's just the Facebook and Instagram account. That's okay. It's really not, right? And it is, the implications can be far more wide reaching than just that first instance as well.
Imagine if that David Doe guy had put a link that was dropping malware on machines. Like this would be a very different story, right? So yeah, I think you're spot on, Dan.
Indeed. Well, the next story is a review of the crypto crash and its implications for cyber criminals now and in the longer term. So, Gar, we've seen the crypto crash occur. What's happening in terms of the cyber criminals and ransomware?
Yeah, is it a good time to buy? You know, now, is it on the dip? What a roller coaster crypto is. I've actually completely stopped it. I mean, I've just backed away from trying to follow what's going on there. It's so incredibly unstable, it seems to me. And all the promises of crypto so far, I mean, it seems to kind of equate to a really good way to steal money when you do a ransomware attack, but I don't really see it being adopted much more widely than that so far in my life. What you're seeing here is as part of the crypto crash, the problem for ransomware crews now is that the thing, you know, the money that they've stolen is worth substantially less than it was pre-crash. And, you know, we're seeing some of the kind of exchanges go out of business completely. So any funds that were kind of tied up are gone, potentially. Sometimes they'll pay, you know, pennies in the dollar, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're an attacker and you're looking at ways to get funds out, that's become less appealing than it maybe was before, where it's become so unstable. That's, you know, if it's, you know, an imaginary coin is worth $100 today, and then you put all this effort in, you put your, you know, you risk yourself with, you know, whatever the kind of local law enforcement agencies are, all the things that go into, you know, stealing money through ransomware. And then, you know, it's worth a dollar or $2 after all of that effort. So no real surprise. And, you know, it's been kind of more broadly spoken about in the industry that you're already starting to see a shift of crews away from ransomware and into, you know, what's almost traditional BEC, you know, social engineering, pay the money into the bank accounts, you know, that sort of stuff. So a little bit less less appealing from a ransomware side of things, and then much more the BEC. And I think we have certainly seen some of those signals. I think in our threat intel teams, where they're picking up more of that kind of that social engineering stuff than the pure play kind of ransomware side of things.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's one of the favorite words of the last couple of years, a pivot, right? That for the cyber criminals, to real currency, right? And that's what BEC is. It delivers, real cash into the bank accounts, and that and isn't, subject to these wild fluctuations. And if they've been planning, long-term sort of attacks and, sort of stealth and sort of taking time to get into things, as we know, happens these days, by the time then they've actually executed the plan, it may be worthless, right? So there's no doubting, I think, that what we will see is, like we've been speaking for a while about ransomware as a service, it feels like it's going to move to BEC as a service, right? In terms of what's going to be offered by the cyber crim. So I don't think they go away. I don't think the risk goes away. I think it just morphs, right? And I don't think ransomware will stop either. I think that's the thing is that,
God, no.
Bitcoin still of a value, and they will still continue to use that as, if it's easy to actually get success, right? I think that's the other thing is that if it's a quick return, even if it's not as lucrative as it may have been, that will still continue to proliferate as well.
Yeah, I mean, and I totally agree. We won't see ransomware going away. Like as a way in, it is almost too easy sometimes. So yeah, I totally agree with you. Fluctuation in, the Bitcoin currency or cryptocurrencies, it is the fluctuation. And that's the other thing. The potential is that the stuff does come back up. And, kind of bounces in a way that makes it more appealing to do ransomware again. I mean, it's the industry we work in. Things change all the time and, stuff becomes popular and then goes away. Certain type of ransomware becomes popular and then goes away. It's sort of it feels like it comes in waves.
Indeed. And if it's not the crypto crash that is going to sort of have that longer term impact on ransomware, what is GAR? What can be done to actually, start to put an end to this?
Well, there's a few things that are happening, I'd say, globally, where you're starting to see with regulations or things like mandatory ransomware reporting, like that starts to get energy behind regulating crypto. That's been talked about for quite some time. And there's been moves by some countries to do exactly that. And, almost immediately you see a drop in value of the crypto currencies. But, that is a way, is to sort of, fundamentally regulate cryptocurrencies and bring them into the tent of society rather than, them sitting outside, which I know is the whole point of cryptocurrencies existing. But that is one sort of approach. You've also got the potential improvement of technical security controls. We talked about passwordless authentication, and maybe some of that stuff starts to help in terms of, people allowing at least their credentials or phishing links to be running amok using credentials. Like that sort of starts to help in a way. It's like, I'd come back and think we spoke about this a year ago or so. I don't think it's one thing. It's probably like 20 things that all sort of have to happen. And then it starts to get to the point where, not that it won't be successful, but the cost of the efforts becomes just like, why bother? Let's go do something else. Maybe we'll see like a return to drugs and good old days of, human trafficking and weapons and, those traditional criminal endeavors.
Well, that's a positive note to end that discussion. I thought we were looking for the positive upside of the end of ransomware potentially. But like you say, it just will change. I'll look for the next sort of, the next crack, if you like, in the system, and the next sort of vulnerability to get Absolutely. Into and exploit that, right? I mean, that's the nature of that game. And so, we've got to continue to make sure that we are, at our best in terms of defense and understanding what those moves look like to try to preempt and be ahead of the game as much as possible. But I think that's the thing is that the cyber criminals move really quickly, right? They are agile because they're money hungry. They're able to move quickly, and they don't have sort of corporate bureaucracies around them to navigate and get through. So I think the ability for good organizations to respond quickly is actually is a challenge. I think that moving feast is actually one of the hardest things to keep up with.
Yeah, I totally agree. What works today, what works this year, won't work next year. I've been thinking about this a little bit lately. It's almost like inflation, where the same dollar spend and same security controls year over year is going to do less because the types of attacks are changing, the sophistication level's changing. Some very, very clever people out there. And they lead. Like, that's the reality. It's not like, technology vendors decide on a new protection approach, and then the attackers go, oh, they've figured out a protection. Let's go, attack in that way. It's completely the other way around. Mm-hmm. So who knows? There was a time where ransomware didn't exist, and we may end up facing something brand new that no one's thought about. Some very clever person figures out a way to make money from cybercrime.
Yeah, indeed. Well, our final deep dive story for this week is one that you sort of alluded to around as we move to a passwordless world, and therefore, how do we start to build in new sorts of, technology as part of that? And one is facial recognition as part of it. And we've seen a bit of a bungled rollout of the facial recognition technology across major Australian retailers of late. What's gone wrong here?
It's kind of a funny one, right? The organizations that are involved, in theory, were doing this facial recognition stuff to add to their security systems, and the idea being that, I suspect, kind of like casinos, when Dan McDermott walks into a store and you're a known shoplifter, your other job, Dan, that, the cameras pick you up and then security escorts you out the door, very much like a casino, right, where they do facial recognition on card counting and, people who are known to be rorting the casinos. similar kind of an idea, right? So, it sounds, okay, like there's a reasonable use case for it. The problem there is the same as the problem in society in general. Like, you roll this up to the macro level of a country and, Met UK, London Metropolitan Police in the UK rolled out broad AI facial recognition for crowded places using CCTV. The idea being very much like one of these stores, that if you're Bob the burglar, that they can pick you up automatically on the cameras, and then somebody can kind of yoink you out of a crowd and job done, society's better. The problem is the payment for that is a bunch of innocent people are getting their details scanned and stored and analyzed, and I think that's the problem here. The organizations involved didn't do a privacy impact assessment, and there's been some conversations and pushes from various folks in a few kind of different bodies. Privacy Commissioner Samantha Gavel was talking about this and kind of called it out that, that if they'd really kind of done a risk assessment, they probably would have seen that it wasn't an amazing idea to do this. And that's the problem. One of the organizations has backed away from using it, and I think it's probably a PR impact more than anything at this stage, where people feel a little bit funny about the fact that they're being analyzed. Here's the dirty secret of most very large malls and stores. They're already tracking everybody. So they're using beacon technology. And when you walk into your local big mall that everybody loves to spend a Saturday at, have a look at the door as you walk in. There's probably going to be some sort of a privacy statement or a statement saying that your information may be collected and shared with third parties. A lot of these places have Wi-Fi systems, the free Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. Man, it sounds amazing. When you connect to that, you show up in a heat map, and it shows exactly where you've walked within the stores, which stores you visited. It becomes part of your data set that data brokers will then on-sell for money. Beacons on Bluetooth, and again, similar kind of deal. They're watching for when you appear and where have you walked close to. Stuff is already sort of happening. So it's not like when you walk into these stores, you're completely anonymous anyway. You're already, to a certain extent, being tracked.
And as you say, I think it links back to that first story of what is that brand and PR impact, right? And we know that the Choice Group have actually filed a complaint to the federal privacy regulator for this use of the facial recognition technology and how it's being stored and being used. So it's, again, it is not just the one-time use and its own sort of, approach and what it's trying to do, but it is the broader implication of what does that mean, and therefore the flow-on effect again for some of these retailers, their brand and their reputation. And these things continue to sort of build, right? And I think it's maybe it's not just the one-time thing, but it's like all of these things start to combine that there'll be less and less trust in a lot of these, you know, institutions, you know, in many ways of across the country. And therefore, like, how, what does that mean in terms of consumer buying patterns and behavior and what happens from there? So there's no doubting that these things have a long range impact, I think. And like you say, you know, it's also the sort of things that can just scare people off, you know, facial recognition in a store. Maybe I don't need that, right? Maybe I'll go and shop at the competitor where they don't do that.
It feels a bit weird, doesn't it? Like, I think that's the thing. And like, as you're talking there, I'm thinking, you know, there's a privacy implication for people walking into the store. And then there's a bigger implication, which is the guys who walk around the store, you know, when you look a little bit dodgy and pretend that they're customers and then, you know, grab you if you try and steal stuff. And I'm not speaking from personal experience here, by the way. This is me imagining what it would be like. But, you know, there's a couple of jobs gone. And that's the other side of this. You know, you've got a computer that's brutally efficient at saying, there's Gar, you know, we busted him for, I don't know, stealing, clothing in some other store. And, you know, let's not let that guy in. What of it? You know, there's a bunch of jobs that go away. And that's, you know, part of this conversation that we still haven't really had. What does it mean when robots can do things so much more efficiently than we can? And like, what do people do to make a living?
Yeah, no doubting. Big implications across the board there. And one, I think, that is going to continue to evolve, and a story that I'm sure will continue to come up over time as well. So finally, let's wrap up with a quick review of the latest breaches and vulnerabilities to make the headlines. Let's start with the global outage of Microsoft Teams and 365 last week and its impact.
Yeah, sort of a bummer for folks who are using Teams as their kind of collaboration tool. Okay, I mean, this isn't kind of a new story or a new thing to happen. We see this stuff all the time. The reason I think it's interesting is just that in a COVID world, I think the impact of this stuff is probably much more significant and severe than it would have been in 2019, for example, where, you know, chances are you could at least walk across a floor and talk to somebody or, you know, pick up a phone. We are absolutely reliant these days on collaboration tools, you know, whether it's Slack, Teams. I mean, there's a bunch of them. And what you saw here was, I think, you know, a little bit of a pulse check on what it means when something like this actually does go down. And I think it was about a 7-hour outage, and it was global. It was all kind of around the world. The sort of that Microsoft have come back out and sort of said it was a result of a recent deployment contained a broken connection to an internal storage service, which has resulted in impact. And, you know, outside of the impact of collaboration becoming unavailable, I think this is something you and I have talked about a bunch of times, which is, you know, that centralization of services and what does it mean if that then goes down? Because it's not a mail server in one organization, it's actually a mail server used by nearly every organization that now is unavailable. So everybody can't connect or communicate with everybody. It's a much, much larger scale event when cloud service providers do have their outages. Years ago, I was talking about the person sitting in a dark room wondering why their internet-enabled light bulb wasn't working, and it was somebody had messed up the config in an S3 bucket. Stuff like that, right? It's a conversation that when it comes to cyber resilience, I don't think we have often enough. We spend our whole time talking about, you know, interesting attacks and vulnerabilities. And actually sometimes somebody kicks a cable or something just a little bit silly happens because there was somebody made a mistake somewhere and you see this. But organizations, I think so often these days, are not thinking about sort of secondary services, secondary data assurance, service assurance, things like that. So definitely an important
point. Yeah, the need for a good old-fashioned continuity plan, hey? Like, it highlights, you know, the risk and the vulnerability there, and like you say, on such a wide scale. And you know, there was lots of posts and social media activity around the Teams outage, what it meant, and interesting reactions by different organizations, you know, obviously some sort of going to other collaboration platforms and particularly video conferencing and that sort of thing, and others refusing to. Like, oh, well, we're down. Like, we can't do it. We're like the corporate standards team, so we're not going to go to an alternative. It's like, is that great for productivity? Is that the right answer? Like, so many things that I think this raises in order for, again, for that conversation to be brought back front and center and to say, you know, these things will happen, and what is it going to be our approach, and how do we sort of rally around and make sure that people understand that? Otherwise, people will sort of fill the void themselves and create their own continuity plans, as we've seen in the past as well.
Yeah, that's where everybody should absolutely start worrying. I've heard some, and I'm guessing you have too, Dan, like horror stories of what people do when the primary services become unavailable and data being sent in ways that, yeah, it just makes me cringe when I hear those stories. But it's an important point of cyber resilience. But it's not sexy. It's not cool. You know, it's not some amazing hacker in a dark room figuring out cool stuff. It's actually just, it's sort of sometimes just dumb bad luck, but actually has a huge impact to businesses.
Well, the next story is probably more of a cool hacker in a dark room. is a mysterious cloud-enabled spyware that's been detected on macOS. What makes this different and unique?
Yeah, it's called Cloud Mensis. And we have a couple of things, I suppose. We don't often see Mac stuff. Tends to be that, you know, the attackers out there will go after Windows because it's used so much more widely for the large part. And there's some other reasons, but, you know, mostly that. This one is also interesting in that what it's done is it actually just relies completely on cloud storage for its command and control activities. So if you can imagine, it gets onto the machine and, you know, it does the usual stuff of using vulnerabilities to get privilege escalation. And then they've got a first stage loader component. But what it does is it connects to the cloud using tokens to various different kind of storage solutions. And, you know, there's a few different kind of providers that are involved here. And then it pulls the commands down from the cloud storage, if that makes sense, and then executes them and then returns the data back up to the cloud storage solutions. So what that means is that there's no domains in the code. There's no IP addresses in the code. It's actually all stored in the C2, in the storage, the cloud storage. So it's actually quite a clever approach to sort of obfuscating the activity and just making it more difficult to detect that this is actually happening. It's not the first time it's been done, but I think it's interesting. You know, it's that combination of Apple, and so a bunch of baristas and designers will be freaking out right now. And then the command and control storage side of things, cloud storage is also kind of an interesting angle.
Yeah, again, making it tougher for everybody to sort of track and be able to, you know, close those vulnerabilities. So definitely an interesting approach there. One that's been around for a little while and just won't go away is Log4Shell. Continues to be a bane in many organizations.
It does, yeah. And, you know, the story isn't Log4j, obviously, but it is the department's, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security saying that it's something going to be, we'll be dealing with the fallout of Log4j for a decade or more. And that actually rings true. I had a conversation with actually one of our customers as part of the event we did last week, which you were also at, and had a beer afterwards. And we were talking about Log4Shell, which makes me sound like a sadder person than I am. Like we should have had a fuller life that we could have talked about something else, but there we go. But he was describing how much of an absolute nightmare, obviously, it was for them as they kind of went through all their third-party providers. Those 30, like the supply chain kind of, you know, goes so far out because who knows, it could be, you know, a seventh degree separation where somebody's using code used by somebody, if that makes sense. And then, you know, further out, that's the problem. Absolute nightmare. And, you know, when we spoke about this last, it's not going to be the last time we see something like this because we've got a huge amount of open source software and software and libraries maintained by volunteers, sometimes one person doing something because they just, you know, are into it and want to kind of produce something good. Yeah, that is bonkers that we're embedding that stuff in very critical enterprise applications. You know, I shudder to think where, you know, if you were able to show a heat map of the types of organizations where this stuff shows up, like Log4j specifically, I think we'd all have a hernia or a conniption and kind of freak out. But, you know, the point is we'll be dealing with, you know, this one for a decade or more, according to the Department of Homeland Security. And here's my big prediction. We're going to see more of it and we'll be dealing with those ones for a decade or more. So there's probably a bigger conversation around, you know, fixing the problem rather than waiting for it to happen again.
Yeah, indeed. Very frightening to think that a vulnerability can last that long when we know how quickly everybody reacts to close these things down, patches, all of those sort of things that we know all best practice, but it still can reside for such a long period of time. Our last story today is how ransomware attacks on small towns across the US continues, with 113 attacks on local government reported in the last 2 years alone. So this seems like, while we said ransomware in the crypto crash might be having an impact, there's certainly been going after local governments in the US at a rate of knots.
Yeah, spot on. And it just kind of felt like a good story to close the loop on, the sort of deeper dive conversation we had earlier on. Yeah, spot on. I mean, we're seeing ransomware continue. And as you said, and I said it too, it's not going to go away. It's less lucrative, but that doesn't matter. The impact will be just as severe. And if you're one of the towns that's going to be hit and potentially locked out of critical systems and services, then it's obviously a continuing worry. It's a huge amount of towns in the US have been hit. We've seen it here locally with some of the councils, and the impact to them, it's not going to go away. We'll potentially see less of it, but ransomware is probably here to stay, unfortunately.
Indeed. Well, thank you, Gar. That wraps up today's episode. Appreciate your insights as always. Who do you have for us as our special guest next week?
Next week, Dan, we've got Lee Robig, who's the customer CISO for Securo. He's a guy I met a couple of months ago, and we had a pretty good conversation about zero trust. So yeah, keen to kind of get him on. And that's going to be the sort of fulcrum of the conversation, but we'll, I'm sure, end up on bunny trails as we always do.
Terrific. Well, looking forward to hearing Lee's episode next week. Until then, if you'd like to continue exploring key topics in cybersecurity, please jump onto getcyberresilience.com and check out some of the latest articles, including why social posts can be an open goal for scammers, some practical advice on what makes a great incident response plan, and you can read the full article on Could the Crypto Crash Spell the End of Ransomware? Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay safe.